This is an interview with Eugene Hauser on March 7th, 2008. We're in the studio at WILL-TV in Campbell Hall, Urbana, Illinois. Henry Radcliffe is doing the videotaping, and my name is Nancy Rotzel. Okay. World War II. Where were you when it started?
I was probably still in high school when it started. Yes, I was, because we didn't get involved until 41. But in 41, I happened to be over at the university at Purdue when Pearl Harbor was bombed.
Well, how did you find out about it?
It was on the radio, I guess. They didn't have TV at that time. Huh. Yeah.
Do you remember the reaction to it?
Then we wonder what effect it was going to have on all of us, yes.
A lot of talk on campus?
Oh, yeah.
And how did you get involved?
Well, I finally got through the university and was drafted at the end. I was out in the field. My father was handicapped, came out with walking with a crutch and had a notice from the draft board to appear for induction, and he wanted me to apply for deferment, and I said, no, I can't. I've got to go.
What year was that?
It was in 44.
And you were in the field where?
In Farmer City, on the farm in Farmer City, yeah. And from there, in October, it was October then, I went to Camp Atterbury in Indiana was for the induction center. And Camp Atterbury, we moved to, didn't know where we were going until we got to Atlanta, the rail yards. Somebody said, well, you're going up to Camp Crofton, South Carolina. So I had a basic training in Camp Croft, trained as an infantry scout. And that's where you're supposed to get all the intelligence and go up in front and see what's going on and report back. At the end of the basic training, we moved to Camp Patrick Henry and then shipped out from Newport News, Virginia, on the USS America, some probably 5,000 replacements. They weren't units then, they were just replacements to fill in the vacancies in the units from the combat. One member of the crew was Red Skelton, the comedian. He was an Army person, served his time on a ship as his Army duties, and in the mean, all the intervals in between his working, he was entertaining all the troops. By the time we got to Naples, he was exhausted.
What was his job on the ship?
I don't know if he was peeling potatoes or what he was doing. But someone got the bright idea as we came to the Straits of Gibraltar at night. They said we'd take a survey, and if they got $5 million worth of Prudential insurance, if the total Prudential insurance had totaled $5 million, they would turn the lights on the rock. So we went through. Of course, there weren't any lights on that, because Prudential is a rock of Gibraltar is a trademark of Prudential Insurance. Then we went on through the Mediterranean over to Bay of Naples, where we disembarked. But we couldn't get to the dock because the bay was full of sunken vessels. So we had to pull up to one vessel and put our gangplank down and walk from one vessel to another to get to the shore. And then they put us in semi-trailers and hauled us out to Count Ciano's dairy farm as a first staging area. Count Ciano happened to be the son-in-law of Mussolini. But from the period of time I was in at the dairy farm, it served sometime as night guard at for the 10th Mountain Division up in the mountains. And from the dairy farm, we moved into Caserta for a staging area. And that staging area was near the Chief Headquarters, which is Supreme High Command of the Mediterranean Theater. And then from there, we moved up to Naples. And before I was assigned to any unit, my spare time, I went to the headquarters and helped the troop movement officer with his duties. And I found out that there was a vacancy in the headquarters for a typist. So I said, well, I can learn, I can type. So they got assigned to the forms writing unit, which cut orders for incoming troops and sent these with their orders, sent them up to the front or wherever they're needed, wherever the replacements were needed. That was the forms writing unit. And becoming a typist, I got rid of my scout MOS, became a clerk typist. Kind of an envious position if you're not, rather than going up to the front with a rifle. And then from Naples we received troops coming in, because that was a port, and sent them up to the front, and we received troops coming back from the front who had enough points to be discharged, or they were being transferred to the Pacific Theater. Whenever a ship came in with troops, we loaded up with people going back. Whether the ships were victory ships or liberty ships or battleships or aircraft carriers. Aircraft carriers would take 8 or 10 personnel back to the States.
How did you decide which ones were going to go or where to place them?
As they came into the depot.
So they needed a certain number of points to go home.
Yes.
And when you were sending them in as replacements, how did you know which ones went where?
Well, if they had enough points, they came to us and we sent them home, and we'd send up replacements for those people. And those who didn't have enough points had a few points were, of course, transferred to the Pacific Theater because they were starving for replacements out there. We had personnel on Iwo Jima and New Guinea. We had fellows on New Guinea that were fighting hand to hand for 36 or 38 days. Without any replacements, because all the replacements are going to Europe. And finally, when Europe was liberated, then we sent the replacements out to the Pacific Theater. My job as a typist, yes, was just an 8-hour shift. Very, very lenient. And in our spare time, we at Naples, we could, on the weekends, we go out to Pompeii, toured, learned all about Pompeii, or climbed Mount Vesuvius, the lava-crusted banks of the Mount Vesuvius, to climb up there and look inside, see all the steam squirting out. Or we could take a PT boat and go to the Isle of Capri, and then Well, that, in Naples, the area we were involved with was and Mussolini was going to have a World's Fair, and so they had a lot of fancy buildings and auditoriums and buildings. We used those. And then we moved up to Florence. But while we were in Naples, we had R&R every 3 months. We could go up to Rome for a week. And in Rome, before going to Rome, I went to the Red Cross because I didn't know anything what about Italy or what about Rome. So I went to the Red Cross and looked in the encyclopedias. What was there in Rome? And, of course, there's the Vatican and all the ruins. So when I went to Rome, first thing I did was went to the St. Peter's Cathedral and saw the Swiss guards. And my ancestors are Swiss. So I took it upon myself to go into the Swiss canteen. I was in uniform. Went into the canteen where the Swiss guards rested and had coffee and so forth. I asked if any of them could speak English, and they referred me to Schmidt Neuer, and we visited for a couple of hours. He said, tomorrow's my day off. If you come back, I'll take you on a tour of Rome. So we saw Rome on foot with a Swiss guard as a guide. Thought that was unique. And then from Naples, we moved up to Florence for 2 months, and doing the same thing, processing troops. And on the weekends, we'd go into Florence and get our hair cut and tour the Pizzi Palace and see the Ponte Vecchio. Got very acquainted with Florence, and the city of Florence. And then we moved to Marina di Pisa. And there we were stationed on a farm, and in the second floor of the barn where we slept, we could look out the window and we could see the Leaning Tower. of course, on the weekends, we'd go into Pisa. And I had the pleasure of climbing the circular stairway clear to the top of the tower. And the huge bells up there that they rang. So we would get on the arm of the bell and get this thing swinging, and it would swing us. It would pick us up the floor, and we'd swing back and forth on that big beat bell. The natives didn't like that, or the Pisans didn't like that because they used the bells for emergencies. Mm. If we were up there ringing the bells, that wasn't protocol. And later on, they found out that the ringing the bells deteriorated the foundation, or it wasn't good for the stability of the tower. And maybe 40 years later, they prohibited anybody from climbing the tower until they found out how to stabilize it.
How did you keep track of what was going on in the different theaters of war?
Well, that came down through we had the Stars and Stripes, the daily paper, and we kept track of the progress up there and in the Pacific. And of course we read Bill Mauldin's cartoons of Willie and George. And I got 3 or 4 books of his. Right away then we moved on into Leghorn, Italy, which is another port city. And ships would come in there and we'd process troops again. And on R&R, we had one R&R that went to Switzerland, a tour, a week, 1 week tour. And if we had Swiss relatives, a blood relative, we could stay with the blood relative instead of staying with the tour. And so a distant cousin of mine became a grandfather. And so I was able to stay with him. And he took us around to where our ancestors grew up and went to school and went to church in Schwarzenberg and Regensburg. And I met a couple of younger cousins that were going to the Polytechnic in Zurich, starting for their doctor's degrees. And we became fast friends, and he came over here after the war several times as he was associated with the Stanford Research Institute. He represented the Near East for the Stanford Research Institute. Anyway, I think I had two R&Rs in Switzerland.
How did the Swiss feel about the Americans?
Well, they were neutral.
So they didn't have any opinion on the war?
Yeah.
I mean, personally.
Our relatives were friendly because we were making progress getting the Nazis out of. My grandfather there had a car, but it was in the garage, covered with the canvas and up on blocks because they couldn't drive it during the war. So we took a train every place.
What year was this by this point?
This is in 45 and 46. In 45, Roosevelt died while I was en route to Italy. In April 45, was it? And
what was the reaction to that?
Well, he became one of us then. He was just a person, a body that passed on. So we were wondering about who was going to replace him. Because he'd been in president for, what, 4 terms?
Do you think that there was a reaction to who his replacement was?
Yeah.
Did you even know it? Do you know much about him?
No, I didn't know much about Truman. But back to you talking about the reaction of the Swiss people. Switzerland was neutral, and we weren't allowed to fly over Switzerland. But one of our planes, our bombers, did fly over there, and the aircraft crew radioed up to him, and they fired at him. And he said, you're flying over Swiss territory. We're going to fire on you. And they did. And he says, your shells are bursting at 21,000. I'm flying at 24,000. And they said, we know it.
How big was the office that you keep saying we moved from here to there? How big was the office you were in? How many people?
Oh, I think there's 4 or 5 typists. Mm-hmm. And we'd cut metal plates, put their information on it. And those, when they came into our depot, they filled out a form. And we put their name and address, like on a dog tag. They had their name and their religion and their blood type on these plates. And off these plates, they'd get their name and put them on with an address graphing machine. We'd cut the long troop movement orders. And then the next day, we'd go out and call off the names and put them on the trucks. And in Leghorn, well, every evening I'd check the incoming troops for anybody who, from DeWitt County or Farmer City, or, and I happened to find one that was Kenneth Westray from the DeWitt County, had been the DeWitt County Sheriff, and he was in the MPs in the Army. So I went over to where he was buried that evening and told him that who I was and that he was going to ship out on a certain ship the next day. And he said, well, this is the first time in my 4 years in the service that I knew what was going to happen to me the next day. While he was in service, his wife was the sheriff of DeWitt County. Interesting facts like that.
He's the only person you ever met? Only one from Illinois, too? Or were there others?
Well, there are a lot of them from Illinois and all over the states. I became acquainted with all the forts because we would send them to Fort Dix or Fort Monmouth or all that. I became acquainted with all those names. And for Illinois, we sent them to Fort Sheridan or Great Lakes.
How did anybody keep track of how many points somebody had to know to send
them back?
That was
by the month's service overseas, and the battles. I think maybe the battles were counted, and the number of children that you had at home. So they each of them counted so many points, and I don't remember the high points, what they were, but we'd ship home the high pointers, and then they kept reducing got down to the low ones.
Well, I just wondered where the records were kept, because you didn't have a computer to pull it all up.
The headquarters of each battalion.
And it was all done on paper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It followed each soldier. Their records did. And back to Leghorn, I became acquainted with James Kubasumi, who was a member of the famed 442nd Infantry Regiment, the Nisis, Japanese Americans, who were imprisoned in Idaho. A bunch of them got together and formed the 442nd Infantry Regiment, and they were shipped to Italy and had some of the worst battles, the dirtiest ones they put these Nisis in. And they had the highest casualties, but they're all successful battles. Very outstanding service. But Jim was in the service. While he was in the depot, he worked at the motor pool and found out that the government was selling surplus vehicles and the surplus Jeeps. And for $150, if you're a sergeant or higher, you could buy a Jeep and it would be sent home as baggage. So Jim picked out a real nice Jeep for me. One that had been in service, on the front bumper, it still had the post that went up above the windshield with a hook on it. So when they'd drive the Jeep down the road, and the Germans would have a piano wire stretched from tree to tree across the road, and this bar would catch that rather than behead the drivers or the Jeep personnel. So the Jeep I got still had this bar on it. So I knew it had been in service. But I brought it home and used it for a run around driving livestock and some field work, pulling a rotary hoe and so forth for about 10 years until I wore it out.
What rank were you that you were able to get one of those?
A sergeant. that tech sergeant. And anyway, I got Jim Kubasumi to come get on the, I got him booked on the same ship that I came home on. It was the Lehigh Victory. Took 12 days to do that. And picked up the Jeep, came on home to back to the farm and got married to Jen, who was a former Purdue student.
What year was that?
That was in 1946. She always claims that I brought her from Indiana to Illinois to improve the bloodlines.
Did you find it hard to come back and adjust to
no.
being on the farm?
Came right back into the harvest time. But my crippled, handicapped father had to put up for 2 years, put up with whoever was available to help with the farm work. I felt bad about leaving him, but I couldn't not serve.
Were there a lot of people that you knew from Farmer City who had gone, who were already in the service when you,
yeah.
friends?
In fact, about 12 years ago, there was a kind of a fair on the main street of Farmer City. And there was a tent next to the library, and some of the fellows were out in the tent talking about their World War II experiences. And John Dawson and John Overton were there talking about theirs, and they thought, well, now these stories ought to be written down for history. And so John Dawson, John Overton, and Fred Graff started collecting stories, and then they needed another accomplice, so I joined them. And it took 8 years to get books, stories for our book. And it was about 1995 or so before the four fellows started talking about their experiences. Some of them were too horrible to talk about, and others they didn't think anybody would be interested in. But we got a couple of them to tell their stories, like from this tent. And we recorded those, and then other people heard those stories, and they said, well, I've got something I can say. And should I say this about Dick Smith, who is farmed south of Parnell, for 50 years, he was just a farmer. And I met him in the Carl Clinic in the waiting room, and his grandson and his wife were with him. And I said, Dick, you were in the World War II. Have you recorded your story? And he says, no, nobody's interested. And I said, you haven't even told your wife what you did? And he said, no. I said, Dick, you should do that. I don't know where you were, but you should write your story. About 2 weeks later, he gave a story to John Dawson. And a week or so later, he said, I've got some more. I can add to that story. And one of the interesting facts was we learned from him that he had been a cook on the Balfin submarine. And for a couple of days, it was docked in the Bay of Naples. And they saw a train go regularly past on a trestle. And that was enticing. The captain got permission to fire the last torpedo. And they knocked that trestle off from underneath that train. And as far as we know, that was the only submarine that was ever credited with sinking a train. And that same submarine was out in the ocean, and And their compass went out of commission for some reason. It was a cloudy night. The navigator couldn't find out where he was from the stars. So he told the captain, "As far as I know, we're 5 miles north on the Burma Road."
What's your book called?
Our book was called The Roles, Their Roles Remembered. R-O-L-E-S, Their Roles. That's stories of what they did. We collected 650 names, and all that we could find out about most of them, maybe 400 of them had stories, like Dick Smith's or Dr. Richard Watson's, or Bill Howard. Bill Howard came back and became a principal at, around one of the suburbs, but he was a pilot on a B-17. That was shot down, and he stayed with the plane until he saw all his crew bail out. And then he bailed out, and he saw every one of those parachuting out was killed before they hit ground. And when he got down to the ground, he as well as some others, the natives would come after him with pitchforks or whatever they had to kill them, because they had bombed their houses, they bombed their cities. They're real aggravated at the fact that there's a chance to get back at them. So when he said, when he was teaching history, modern history in school, it came to the World War period, he couldn't talk about it.
Was that true of a lot of the men that you got to write, that they hadn't talked about it before?
Yeah. And they finally loosened up and talked.
Think it's easier to write about it than talk about it?
Yeah, probably.
So some of them just gave you the written thing and didn't talk about it?
Another Air Force veteran was Dean, Dean Holman. His plane was shot down, and as he was floating down from his plane, before he got to ground, a German fighter plane passed him. A lot of times when the German planes would come back and they'd shoot these parachutists, but this one came back and waved to Dean. And so Dean said, "Well, no time to not be cordial," so he waved back to him. And when he landed, but he'd been shot in the leg and in the POW camp, he had to lose one leg.
Do you think it helped them to talk about it?
Beg your pardon?
Do you think it helped them to talk about it?
I think so, yes.
Did you all get together at the end of the book? Have another another tent party?
No. Because by that time, in 8 years, many of them had passed on. And that's the reason 10, 12 years ago, we wanted to get these stories down, because they are dying. Veterans are dying at 1,000 a day. Is that right? 1,000 a day? Pretty frequently, anyway. You see in the newspapers, the obituaries, there'd be a flag with the obituaries. There'd be 5 or 6 obituaries with flags on them. So we had to get those stories recorded before they were lost. That's one of the more facts of my life, something I was proud to do, to record those.
Looking back at it all, how do you feel about World War II and being part of it all?
It was necessary. We had to. And the country, everybody in the country was involved with it. As civilians, they were in munitions, or they were assembling jeeps or making tanks. One of our stories we included others that were in wartime efforts back in the States. One fellow from Farmer City painted war victory ships up at the plant north of Henry. I forgot the name of it, but Kaiser made victory ships up there, and they flowed them down the Illinois River into the Mississippi. But he painted those ships, and we included his story in our book.
Did your dad know you were writing it?
No, he died.
How did he feel when you? He said, "What did he say to you when you got home?"
"Welcome home, son." Yeah.
How had you kept track of what was happening at home?
Well, we sent victory letters. We'd write a letter, and then it would be microfilmed, I think, and sent home, and then they'd reconstitute the victory, the microfilm into a victory letter, and send it back to the family. Oh, we did. When I was in Switzerland one time, I called for $13. You could make a phone call back to the States. So I was there, and I made arrangements for it, and had Jan went from Indiana back to where my folks lived, and I said I'd be calling at a certain hour. And so for $13, I talked for 3 minutes to the family. Otherwise, it was just by mail.
You keep touch afterward. Did you keep in touch with any of the special friends that you'd met?
Oh, yes.
Any in particular?
One was Jim Kobusumi. Got Alzheimer's and passed away about 2 years ago. And two of our other typists, one of them has died, and the other one is in Colorado. He came home as a sergeant, and on the GI Bill, he became a veterinarian. And after working as a veterinarian in the States, he re-enlisted and was a officer in the veterinary corps. And he stayed there for his 20 or 30 years. I've forgotten how many. As retired, but that was another buddy.
Did you all get together?
We visited each other, yes, once or twice.
And did you talk about what happened then?
No. We just talked about our families.
Not until the book.
No. Well, John Dawson. Oh, I should mention John Dawson. He was a member of the first Special Service Forces. The Special Service Forces, he was in the first one. They were trained to do anything. They trained for mountain skiing or scuba diving. Infantrymen. They were sent to the Aleutian Islands, and they got up there. They invaded it, and they found out the Japanese had already abandoned the Kiska, the island, and their ship to Norway for their skiing, and their white uniforms and everything for skiing. And then he was down in Italy in the battle of the Anzio battle, and into Italy, south of Rome. There's a Mount Defensia, which that mountain controlled a main highway from Naples up to Rome. And the Germans were situated on top of that mountain. And two American divisions and one British division had tried to conquer that mountain. But their three divisions were backed off. And so his special service force, I think there's 1,500 in the force. In 2 days, they repelled straight up on the backside of this mountain. They'd repel at night and then rest in the daytime and then climb up and again the next day. And in 2 days, climbing up, and they surprised the Germans and captured them. And they had to wait several hours before they got reinforcements to help them. The Special Service Force had captured them. Then they needed American forces to come up and take over. And I think one of the generals didn't have anything to do with the Special Service Forces. They thought that they could, their men could do it. But then after this Mount Defensa campaign, the Special Service Force was accepted. And then John Dawson's unit was the first ones to liberate Rome.
Is that in the book?
He was one of our authors, and we were quite proud to be associated with him. Every time we'd meet, we'd learn more about his experience. About taking Mount Defensa and fighting on the NCO. His unit was became the I've forgotten. Anyway, they'd go out at night and capture the Germans, kill the Germans. And they became the Devil's Brigade. There's been a couple of movies made about the Devil's Brigade. And it was this first service force that John Dawson is a member of.
You obviously have a lot of respect for all of the different experiences
and
that
John
people
Dawson,
have.
The other author, was an interrogator for German prisoners up in Germany.
He spoke German?
He spoke.
Was that something he learned in order to do that?
He was taught that 2 years in the service, and then they sent him over as an interpreter.
If you were going to tell a grandson something about World War II, what would it be?
I think I'd have to... my service was not a heroic service. I'd try to bring out what some of the other soldiers did, but I'd probably tell them that I was a clerk typist and all my education, high school and college, the only course that helped me was my typing course. That got me out of the infantry into as a clerk typist, and otherwise I might have been up there in the front.
What would you tell them about the whole war, not even just your part of it?
Oh. Well, it was a conflict in which we had to enter. We were involved in it before the war in supplying materiel. That Pearl Harbor, that broke the bridge, and we had to join the effort then with personnel. I just tell them that I was proud to serve, and hope that he wouldn't have to.
Is there anything else you want to tell us about?
I think that's about it.
Important time in your life.
Beg your pardon?
An important time in your life.
It was.
That
2 years, we went. It wasn't by choice that I was Kirk typist, but we went where we were ordered. And the saying was, it's not ours, not ours to. It's not our choice. What is that? I've forgotten.
The do or die.
Yeah, it ends up. Yeah.
But that's what people did.
It's not ours to reason why, but ours is to do or die. And that's it. Not to reason why. Okay.